人工衛星人。Transmission of light. We're celebrating our family this week, our spiritual family of Zen ancestors. And it looks like that was Keizan's intention to collect these stories.To celebrate his family. In some ways, his situation was not so unlike ours. Zen was a new tradition in Japan at that time, brought to Japan by Dogen Zenji. Dogen died in 1253, and 15 years after Dogen's passing, Keizan was born. It's the early days of Zen in Japan. It's a little different because Buddha Dharma had been in Japan since 6th century or maybe earlier.The doctrinal schools of Buddhism were flourishing. It was a Buddhist country, but it didn't yet include this separate transmission outside the scriptures we call Zen. It was a kind of a radical fledgling movement.Started by Dogen and Rinzai Zen, just beginning also around the same time with Eisai. And during Dogen's lifetime, it seemed like not so many people practicing with him.It was, again, a small new movement. People didn't realize the genius of Dogen until many centuries after his life. It was also a time in Japan where many other new schools of Buddhism were beginning. Shinran, and with the starting a new movement of the Pure Land tradition, Nichiren,starting a new school, praising the Lotus Sutra. So there was a lot of kind of a revival of Buddhist movements that were all quite different all around the same time. So they were each trying to present themselves as legitimate in some ways because they were new movements.And part of the history here too is that three generations after Dogen, the teacher Tetsu Gikai, who was Keizan's root teacher, there was some kind of controversy. Maybe we wouldn't go so far as to say scandal, but some big problems.With that third generation at Eheiji. You may have heard about this. We don't even know the exact nature of what happened there, but Gikai in his 70s, who was abbot of Eheiji, was kicked out of Eheiji. This is the early days of Soto Zen, right? Trying to establish this new tradition in this country that was actually resisting it.In many ways, it made one story is that Dogen went to Eheiji because he was kicked out of Kyoto, the capital city, by other Buddhist schools that didn't like this new movement. So things were not so settled, and they were just trying to establish themselves. Dogen left this great legacy, and yet just after he died, turmoil arose in the in Eiji, which was like, I think still maybe the only Soto Zen temple in Japan. So it was in this situation that Keizan wanted to basically save this floundering tradition by celebrating this amazing family lineage going back to the Buddha, these awakening stories, saying, let's not lose this. There's something precious and beautiful here to celebrate. And we could maybe say, in some ways, maybe somewhat political, you know, establishing the legitimacy of this new lineage. And in America, we could say, in our particular Suzuki Roshi lineage, he was the great founder bringing Zen to a new country, somewhat like Dogen. I think as the years go by, Suzuki Roshi becomes more and more the mythical, incredible, magical figure like Dogen. And Suzuki Roshi, I think, was a very special character. His teachings and way of trying to bring Zen to a new country was unique. And then in the generations following him, there's been some trouble in those next generations. And in some ways I relate to Keizan being in the fourth generation after Suzuki Roshi. It's kind of like things are maybe settling down a little bit after the rough transition to a new country. And how are we going to really establish the practice in this new land? So it's a celebration of awakening. It's a celebration of light. Again and again, each one of these stories is about light. The inconceivable radiance of our true nature. The light that shines through all conditioning and habitual fixations, limited understandings. The inconceivable light that circulates freely and illuminates everything. This is the essential light that has kept Zen alive through all these centuries and countries. And there were, as you may know, other records of the Zen ancestors that Keizan based his teaching on. Transmission of the Lamp in China. Huge, huge volume, starting with the same Indian ancestors through Bodhidharma, through the sixth ancestor in China, and then branching out to many, many different streams and lineages. So that lamp, actually quite a few different lamp collections in China, didn't just pick up one particular lineage stream. It's like a tree branching out, huge, huge volumes, thousands of Zen ancestors. Even the lineages that died out are still all recorded. It's just basically, let's just include every little alleyway that the light traveled down. Whereas this is a little different. Kaizan collected his stories from these lamp records in China, but he just traced this one particular lineage that led up to his teacher's teacher. His teacher was still alive when he gave these talks, so it may be that he thought it wasn't appropriate to tell the story of his own living teacher at that time. But this transmission of light is the stories from Shakyamuni Buddha up to Kuun Ejo, who Kaizan also practiced with before he received Dharma from Tetsu Gikai. So, of course, much more could be said about Kaizan and the context of this text, but let's jump in. We start today with the ancestor Dungshan. Dungshan Liangje, cave mountain good servant, is his Dharma name. And he has a honorific, maybe posthumous name of Wupen, which means enlightenment origin. And he was the 38th ancestor. And as you know, the founder of the Dungshan lineage, the Sao Dung lineage that we and our own floundering, wallowing sort of way are trying to continue in this country. The these cases, these chapters all begin with a case, a koan story, and then they give the circumstances of that ancestor's life collected from these Chinese lamp records, and then Teisho, or Nente, they sometimes call, or Teisho, which is Kaizan's talk on the story. Maybe somewhat like this Sashin format talks. They have that flavor of being kind of like spontaneous oral expressions, a little less structured and poetic than Dogen's Shobo Genzo. The 38th ancestor was Great Master Dungshan Wupen. He visited Yunyan, Cloudy Cliff, his teacher, and asked, "Who can hear the non-sentient preach the Dharma?" Or another translation is, "Who can hear the inanimate teach Dharma?" That's the subject of this story. And we'll talk more about this, of course, because this is the main point, and there's a whole tradition of stories about non-sentient teaching Dharma. But just at the beginning, let me just mention that I found it interesting that this term non-sentient, Mu Se or Mu Jo, this character Se, in a, at least in modern Japanese dictionary, means something like feeling or emotion or passion or kind of like humanness, human sentiment, which has a little different feeling than just sentient or animate in general. And it's kind of like We could translate it as, who can hear the non-emotional teaching the Dharma, the teaching of the non-passionate, the teaching of those who are not turned around by all the emotional troubles of human beings. And you just keep that in mind as you hear different versions of the story. So, who can hear the non-sentient teach the Dharma? Yunyan answered, the non-sentient can hear the non-sentient teach the Dharma. And the teacher, Dongshan, in this case, the student, Dongshan asked, do you hear it? Or, do you hear it? Yunyan replied, if I could hear it, you would not be able to hear me teach the Dharma. And Dongshan said, in that case, Yangje, meaning I, don't hear you teach the Dharma. So the teacher says, if I could hear it, you wouldn't be able to hear me teach the Dharma. And Dongshan says, in that case, I don't hear you teach the Dharma. Yunyan said, well, if you don't hear me teach the Dharma, how much less can you hear the non-sentient teach the Dharma? And Dongshan was greatly awakened at this point and spoke this verse. Wonderful, wonderful, the teaching of the Dharma by the non-sentient is inconceivable. If you try to hear with your ears, it is hard to understand. When you listen with your mind's eye, then you know it. It doesn't literally say mind, it just says when you listen with your eyes, you know it, but this interpretation here is with your mind's eye. Yunyan approved. So that's the story. And without getting into the whole non-sentient business quite yet, because we'll come back to it. First, some circumstances of Dongshan's life. Yes?
Dongshan's second response.
So, the story basically here, which is a kind of a section of a much longer series of dialogues about the non-sentient, but the heart of the matter here is, I'll read the whole story again. Dongshan said, who can hear the non-sentient teach the Dharma? Yunyan said, the non-sentient can hear the non-sentient teach the Dharma. Dongshan said, do you hear it? Yunyan said, if I could hear it, you would not be able to hear me teach the Dharma. And Dongshan said, in that case, I don't hear you teach the Dharma. Yunyan said, if you don't even hear me teach the Dharma, how much less can you hear the non-sentient teach the Dharma? And he woke up. So you might not find these stories about the lives of these ancestors so interesting, but I always really appreciate them because it makes them like real people. Like they lived at a particular time, and this was, you know, some of them we know a lot about, some we know almost nothing about. But the Indian ancestors in this record especially are shrouded in the mists of ancient obscurity. So maybe some mythical legends around them. But by this time in China, all these things were being recorded. So we actually do know about their lives. This is like 9th century China, when Dongshan lived. The master's name was Lianjie. Yeah. Good servant. Servant of Buddha. He was from Huiqi and his family name was Yu. While still young, he read the Heart Sutra with a teacher. When he reached the place where it said, there's no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, he suddenly felt his face with his hand. And he asked the teacher, I have eyes, I have ears, I have nose, tongue, and the rest. Why does the sutra say that they don't exist? Maybe kind of obvious question. But as the story goes, his teacher was amazed at this question. Nobody's ever asked me about the meaning of the Heart Sutra before. Uh-oh. Because it does kind of look like he does have some eyes and ears over there. The sutra explicitly says there are no eyes and no ears. So the teacher was amazed, and realizing that he was unusual, after all, he's just a young boy, he said, I'm not your teacher. I can't be your teacher. That's too big a question for me. So he sent him to Zen teacher Lingmo on Mount Wuxie, where he had his head shaved. He became a novice monk under Wuxie. When he was 20, he went to Mount Sung, where he received the complete precepts, his full ordination. He was his mother's favorite child since his elder brother had died. His younger brother was poor, and his father was dead. Difficult family life. But once he yearned for the teaching of emptiness, he left his old mother for good, vowing, I will not return to my native place and pay respects to my mother again before I acquire the Dharma. With this vow, he left his native place. It might sound not so compassionate. And if you know this story, I think this will be a controversial one to hear. If you don't know this, you'll be shocked at the next part here. Remember, he's his mother's favorite child, and in China, family relations were generally quite good, as far as I understand. Filial piety was very important. Family units were very close. We can imagine there must have been problems sometimes that, you know, even within such a structure. But I like to imagine that Dongshan deeply loved his mother. And as many of these ancestor stories go, including the Buddha as the original example, felt like he had to leave home. He had to leave all these familiar relationships with their difficult karmic patterns. Our you know, patterns with our parents are so entrenched. After decades and decades, we sometimes still fall into that kind of like our childhood patterns with our parents. It's amazing, huh? It's because that's the relationship we're born into. It's the way we learn to relate to other beings first, is with our parents. So often a deep love and often many entangled karmic patterns in such a relationship. And maybe his feeling was just like, it's too complicated to really cut through all these patterns if I'm, you know, if I'm relating with my family in this way. Now, I think we might say that that's a good place to really work on cutting through, but maybe advanced practice. And at this point in his early practice as a young man, it felt like too difficult to work through it there. And he does say, I won't return until after I realize the Dharma. And the Buddha said the same thing. He said, I'm leaving home. It's not like I'm never coming back, but first I have to do this work, clarify this mind, open this light, and then go back. And Shakyamuni Buddha did go back home, and with his new light, and basically, as the story goes, they weren't so upset anymore. They were very upset when he left, but when he returned, his light just enveloped them, and they all basically joined his practice. There's another Zen ancestor who said something like, you know, once you leave home, don't return to your native village, because the old women in the town will call you by your childhood name. Meaning, like, they'll just relate to you in this old way, and that will very easily, like, pull you back into your old way. And I think we might say, well, we can work with that. It's a challenging practice, but a good challenge. But I think these examples are interesting because they just demonstrate how these great ancestors found it so hard to deal with these situations that they made these pretty radical vows. I had a good friend of mine from Tassajara who felt like the practice at Tassajara was too distracting. And he went off to practice in Japan and Korea and China. And while he was over there, he kind of made this vow. He told me about this vow. He said, I went to Japan for a year and we practiced in the same place for a while there. And I asked him, you've been here for like 5 years or so already in that monastery, and saying, when are you going back? And he said, I really don't want to go back to the U.S. Until I really am clear. I've really clarified this mind. I think he just felt like, even to go to that country of America is too distracting. So I admired him. His vow was deeply committed. He eventually did come back. So he left his native place. Eventually, Dongshan completed his study and later went to live on Mount Dongshan. Since his mother was alone and had no one else to depend on, she looked for him every day, finally wandering around with some beggars. She became destitute and longed for her favorite son. I remember her husband has died and the elder son has died. When she heard that her son was out on Mount Dung, she yearned to go and see him. And she got there, and Dongshan avoided her, barring the entrance to the room so she couldn't enter. This sounds extreme. It was because he had vowed not to meet her. Consequently, his mother died of grief outside his room on the steps of the temple. Died of grief I finally found my son and he won't even like let me in to say hi. It's, I can feel it in my heart just telling the story. It's so powerful. What's going on here? This is our great founder of our lineage, right? After she died, Dongshan went personally. Then he went to her body and took the small amount of rice she had collected as a beggar, and he mixed it with the community's morning rice gruel. By offering it to the whole community of monks, he made a funerary offering to assist her on her journey to future Buddhahood. I have this sense that like, he deeply cared about the this ultimate concern of his mother's Buddhahood, that more than he cared about this, the emotional connections of child and parent in this one quickly fleeting impermanent life. Not long after, according to the story, his mother came to Dongshan in a dream and said, "Because you firmly maintained your resolve and did not meet me, I severed the delusive feelings of grasping attachment and emotional stuckness. As a result of the power of these good roots, I was reborn in the realm of the satisfied celestials," or Tushita heaven. So, who knows if the whole story happened at all? Who knows if she even came and he turned her away at all? Who knows if that was Dongshan's vision? Who knows if she really was in Tushita heaven? But as the story goes, it seems to be implying that all ended well. She actually was able to finally realize a very happy, peaceful place from which she could continue her practice to complete Buddhahood. Now, we could, you know, stop and talk about this story for a while, but this is sort of a side story. But since it's such a strong story, and I invite you to offer any reflections or questions about this. What's going on? Why did this story get recorded? How do you feel about this? If you'd like. Yes, Alex.
When I hear this story or similar stories, it causes me to think of the absolutely unimaginably excruciating internal conflict that these practitioners must have felt, because they were born and raised in a Buddhist culture with a temple and monasteries. So the drive to perhaps if they had a rosary seeking mind, the drive to ordain was much stronger than maybe any of us could possibly feel. On the other hand, they also had a sense of, like you said, filial piety, also unlike anything we could possibly the cultural emphasis on devotion to your parents. So those two forces, both opposing forces, both stronger than anything we most of us could probably ever feel, colliding with each other. And that is one example of what?
Of the collision.
Yeah. It's very, very, very opposing, yet powerful force.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think it's also interesting that we have so much emphasis on, in our current American Zen, particularly on no gaining idea, like what kind of Buddhahood is he looking for somewhere else, right? I have to cut off everything because I don't have it now. I need to get it. That way of thinking, like, you know. And I think most of the stories have this, you know, we might call way-seeking mind, not being satisfied with what is now, going further onward, deeper, knowing we have attachments and emotional obscurations and deeply vowing to not just accept them as they are. Maybe that is the first and foremost necessary practice, but to actually see through this, realize the complete freedom of Buddhahood. But it sounds kind of dualistic, maybe to our ears. And also, unusual to our modern ears, I think, is this. Where we talk so much about integration, right? Integrating our practice with family life, for example. It's all about that. Especially in a lay sangha or have active lives in the world, this kind of thing seems so far-fetched. So maybe the exact story wouldn't apply to how we approach our practice, but maybe the question is, can we find an encouraging principle? Not so much like we're going to block our mother when she comes to the door, but more like the principle of vow and deep, deep intention to get to the bottom of this great matter.
For me, the kind of root question is, what does it mean to leave home, and what is being released, what is being let go of? And there's a, you know, context of family, just because that's a, you know, classic deep walking away. But I think it's an even more profound question that may or may not have anything to do with leaving home.
Yeah. Also because, I think society was different in that, there were these big extended families living together, so multi-generational kind of thing, living together, whereas that's actually unusual in America. Like, we actually do leave our parents' home early on, usually, often as a teenager. Maybe most people do stop living with their parents pretty early on as a kind of norm, where I think here it was, in that culture, my understanding is that that was unusual. So in that sense, we leave home, but then we start a new home with our new kind of current family. And of course, in that tradition, that was the case in old China too, and people would leave their new home as well. So yeah, I think it's a deep question. Still, of course, we still call priest ordination in the Zen tradition, shuke tokudo, which literally means leaving home to attain freedom. So, but people often do the ceremony, and then right after the ceremony they go home. in a kind of literal way. So yeah, what does it mean to leave home? And as times change, we like to reflect on, well, it's an inner kind of metaphorical home that we're leaving. I think we also have to acknowledge that for, basically over 2,000 years, it was a literal thing as well, and maybe not always as well as the inner. Maybe sometimes there was a lot of inner attachment, but it was just an outer. And it's a kind of modern thing to call leaving home just an inner attitude. And I think we could apply that to a lot of practices, like, Buddha's mind pervades everything, so why do you have to like sit for 5 days and actually, Zazen is the same in any posture, in any activity. We have such teachings, right? So, but those of us who are here, we say yes, and we're going to like physically and literally not move. And they're closely related. As we know, it's easy to say Buddha's mind pervades movement, but something, we're okay physically not moving too. Maybe that's the thing, is like, in the end, are we okay at home or not at home? Are we okay moving or not moving? And we may even have preferences okay too, but is it okay if our home disappears or we have to not move on our seat for a little while?
A personal history may bear on this, or it may let this bear on the history. My own mother was extremely inappropriately attached to me. And it was extremely toxic and enmeshed. And in 1994, when I was 46, I finally had to say, no more. And I did that. Mm-hmm. Literally. I never saw her again, talked to her again. What's interesting is that in my relationship, my significant relationship that I was in, the most important to date in my life, I had replicated that same kind of admission. Although I felt some personal liberation from the tyranny of my mother's inappropriate affection, I had become a tyrant myself. And was perplexed that anybody would object to that. I had that world blow up and entered formal practice. So that was 2002. And what I've learned since is that I never did know intimacy in an enmeshed situation.
Yeah, I think so. That's it. One nice thing in your story is, which I hadn't thought of more before hearing this, but maybe there's some unwritten parts of the story that his mother was not just a loving, kind mother, who in a balanced kind of way, but maybe she was like totally obsessive, like constantly like, where's my little Dung Chong? Where's my little Dung Chong? He's like, oh man.
Yeah.
And
she
could have been like really kind of crazy. I mean, she did end up as a beggar in this, wandering around distraught. So it may be that they had actually maybe a dysfunctional relationship.
Yeah.
They didn't know how to record that.
I had a real palpable sense after coming into practice that it was also good for her and for my practice as well that I did that sometime before. that it was so toxic it would have been deathly.
Yeah. So, you know, compassion is definitely foremost in our practice, and this is not the usual way it looks, but maybe that's another way to hear this story is sometimes, maybe very rarely, and I think this is a rare story of compassion in here, sometimes compassion could look like this kind of tough love to the extreme. It could have been the greatest thing. And maybe, I'm also not written into the story, maybe when she's knocking on the door, "Dongshan, I finally found you." Maybe he was behind the door crying, "I can't let her in. I love her so much." But like, the skillful means at this point is just don't open the door, although I'm longing to. I wish nothing other than to open this door for her sake. I can't do it now. It's another twist on story.
I'm appreciating the message that I think I'm hearing and how the mother is written into the story, that she achieves an enlightenment, an unexpected enlightenment, possibly, by having circumstances push her to a place that she didn't know how to choose. So that, I know that I've experienced similar, maybe nothing as extreme as the story communicates, and I think that's a powerful teaching.
Yeah. Like Sashin is a good example, something that pushes us into a kind of letting go that we actually wouldn't maybe be able to do on our own.
And at the same time, I'm having to sit with a lot of emotions, thinking about that story and how we're thinking about it, because maybe she wasn't crazy.
Yeah.
She was just poor.
Mm-hmm.
What if she really missed her? So, and it reminds me of one of the difficulties that we have when we, I've done it in more than one form now, practice in a religion that has a patriarchal history. It's not the religion so much that's patriarchal. In this case, maybe it's Confucianism. Maybe. I think the story may be capable of being read literally, but it probably has some mythic qualities as well. And Confucianism is making a lot of worries about how family rules get mythologized, and inherent her as kind of an archetype of the mother role, which in this case is the parent role, that a young man must reject in order to do what Buddhism does or what Zen does, which is it rejects the pressure of Confucianism and says, away, which is a very powerful, like you were saying, revolutionary act. Sounds to me, if I understand the history correctly, at that time for to do that.
Yeah.
So, with that in mind, I'm just thinking, as I was hearing the story, I was thinking, wow, here's another story of a cultural situation where an older woman can't achieve enlightenment without being harmed by men, and where the central character that we're all supposed to identify with, again, is a young man.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of shaking in my seat right now because I have such a hard time. Mm.
Yeah, you can hear that in here for sure, yeah. Yes.
I just want to thank you for saying that, because I couldn't find my own skillful way to speak about the quality of how it could tip into really just being misogynistic. Mm. And for me, the way I felt I could make this meaningful today, because we are still in a patriarchal society where people can actually quite easily hate women in certain ways. If the story is just about really attachment, and that's just a symbol of attachment, then the current attachment in modern society is really kind of around success or fame or status. That's really, we leave our families very quickly. We kind of can dislike them very quickly, but we are very attached to something to do with success, whatever it is.
So that's good.
For us, that's what we need to be able to shut the door on, not our mothers or our fathers or our anything really in this culture, because that's the thing if we're going to have a symbol.
I think that's true that, like as Alex was saying, we can't even imagine in this culture that that was the symbol for, like, number one attachment, maybe that family mother-child bond. And I think we still, of course, that plays out here. But you're right that we have other ones. And maybe you could say this is just a symbol for, in that culture, the strongest attachment, or at least how people thought of that. And so if you say fame and profit, you know, Dogen is constantly harping on that one as the big attachment. How do we shut our door when that comes knocking? would you like this new job? You'll get double the amount, and it's double the prestige. Even though, you know, you're not going to be able, it's a 60-hour work week, so you're going to have to give up all your meditation practice to do this. But fame and profit, and then that might be an example in modern life, like, just close the door. Thank you, that's a good one, yeah. Now, what do you know? For each of us, it's different. But, shutting the door on our strongest attachments, and shutting the door in a kind way, or again, this image of maybe Dongshan's crying behind the door, just keep it this boundary. Keep this, the door is like a boundary, right? So hard, but like, this is my vow, and, I will not open the door to the realm where my karmic tendencies will completely overwhelm me, because if I open it a crack, I know they will. So there's one, maybe one of the most radical and extreme stories in the whole book, I think, whenever this one comes up. So now Kazan's going to tell some more stories. He says, though none of the ancestral teachers was superior or inferior in virtue, yeah, I often like to talk this way, all the ancestors are equal because they equally radiate the light that isn't more or less. None of them was superior or inferior in virtue. Dongshan, the ancient ancestor of our school, especially promoted Soto Zen in this way. It was the power of leaving parents and strongly maintaining his resolve. Or we could say the power of leaving attachments and strongly maintaining his resolve. When he began his study, he studied in Nan Chuan's community at first, and was involved in the anniversary of Matsu's death. Matsu was the teacher of Nan Chuan, and they were doing the monthly memorial, and while they were preparing the offerings of tea and rice for the memorial ceremony, Nan Chuan asked the monks, tomorrow we're going to provide offerings to Matsu in the ceremony, but do you think that he will come? The monks were silent, and Dongshan stepped forward and said, if he has a companion, he will come. Nan Chuan said, though he is young, talking about Dongshan, he is extremely suitable for cutting and polishing. Like, he's a good vessel, but he needs to be, now we can get the work on him. Dongshan said, don't turn the good, which in this case is Liang in his name, don't turn the good into something shameful. You know, don't turn me, that's already okay, into trying to fix me up into something better. What are you talking about, cutting and polishing? He's a feisty young monk. Next, he studied with Guizhan. He asked him, "Lately, I hear the national teacher Wei Chung of Nanyang has a saying about the non-sentient preaching the Dharma, but I still don't grasp its subtleties." So this is the extended version. Before this conversation, that's the main case. Dongshan is with Guizhan, and he has this question about this teaching that he heard about. I've heard that Hui Chung has this saying about non-sentient beings teaching the Dharma, but I don't grasp its subtleties. Guizhan said, "Do you remember it? Do you remember the story?" And Dongshan said, "Yes, I remember." Guizhan said, "Well then, give it a try." Dongshan said, it goes like this. A monk asked, "What is the mind of the ancient Buddhas?" The national teacher said, "Fences, walls, roof tiles, and pebbles." The monk asked, "Aren't these all non-sentient?" The national teacher said, "They are." The monk asked, "Or will you explain how they teach the Dharma?" The national teacher said, "They constantly teach it, vigorously, without ceasing." The monk asked, "Why can't I hear it?" The national teacher replied, "You don't hear it, but that doesn't hinder that which does hear it." This translation says, "You don't hear it, but that doesn't stop others from hearing it." But I like, "You don't hear it, but that doesn't hinder that which does hear it." You don't hear it, but you not hearing it doesn't hinder that which does hear it. The monk asked, "I wonder if anyone else can hear it." The national teacher said, "The holy ones, or the saints, can hear it." The monk asked, "Can you hear it?" The national teacher replied, "I can't hear it." The monk asked, "Well, if you can hear it, how do you know that non-sentient beings teach the Dharma?" The national teacher answered, "Fortunately, I can't hear it. If I did hear it, I would be the same as these holy ones, and then you would not be able to hear me teach the Dharma." The monk asked, "Then do sentient beings have no part in it? Like the non-holy ones?" The national teacher said, "I teach for the sake of sentient beings, not for holy people." The monk asked, "After sentient beings hear it, then what?" The national teacher said, "Then they're no longer sentient beings." The monk asked, with some doubt, "What's the scriptural basis for the teaching of the Dharma by the non-sentient?" The national teacher replied, "Clearly, words that do not accord with the sutras are not discussed among gentlemen." Like, you wouldn't dare imply that my words would not accord with the sutras. Don't you know that the Avatamsaka Sutra says, "Worlds teach, sentient beings teach, and all things of the past, present, and future teach." So that's the, he quotes that whole story about the national teacher. Quite complex story. Yes.
Just a sort of like a secondary point to that whole dialogue. What a great example of persistent practice.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
He didn't get scared to keep on. I don't get it. I'm going to ask again.
Yeah.
I don't get that. I'm going to ask again.
Yep.
He didn't have shame and he didn't,
yeah.
He didn't tire out. He just.
Or just pretend that he got it.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
No, he just kept going.
Yep.
And the teacher, incredibly compassionate.
Stayed with him. Yep.
Just tracked.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, persistent. And also personal. He's like, well, did you hear it? You know, that might have been even kind of presumptuous in those days.
Mm-hmm. That reminds me of like a three-year-old wanting to get into the wise thing. they're very persistent. They have such an open mind. Mm-hmm. And they don't have all these conventional layers on understanding things.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they often get you to a place as a parent where you actually can't answer them.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of parents get to the point where they just say, just, you know, that's just the way it is. You know. Don't ask any more questions.
Lonely, why is the sky blue? So obvious to ask, but like, why would you want to know that? Yeah, it's that fresh beginner's mind quality. Yes.
It's happening earlier than I thought it would, but I'd like to jump into Dongshan's skin for a second and ask about this issue of saving sentient beings. I've been thinking lately that a sentient being is a being that is capable of making an appropriate response. A non-sentient being just is what it is. And there's a certain arrogance I detect. I don't know if other people agree with this idea of sapient beings saving sentient beings.
Sapient?
Sapient, yeah, Homo sapiens. Like, you know, enlightened humans saving mere sentient beings. Because it seems to me that the essential quality of sapience, the essential quality of our intelligence, say, beyond that of a dog, is that we are more and more and have cultivated a brain that is exquisitely capable of making an inappropriate response. And that really is a distinguishing mark of our species, is that we can make inappropriate responses with some intention in a way that a cockroach or a bird doesn't. And so to say that we're going to save sentient beings, I think it can only be at this point that we're going to save sentient beings from our sapience. And in a sense, we have to restore our own beginner's mind that is more like a baby at birth or a pet or something like that. And so I hear Dongshan basically asking that question, like, who the hell do you think you are, really? Let's really look at it carefully. And at that point, I think I can see that a wall teaches Dharma. A wall is exactly what it is and does not deviate from that.
Yeah, there's going to be some interesting discussion later around Kazon talking about, does non-sentient actually mean walls, tiles, and pebbles? That's how we usually interpret. But if you read ahead, he's going to say, actually, maybe non-sentience is a quality of human beings, actually. And the way you bring it up in terms of appropriate response, you know, you could say sentient beings are greatly capable of making many inappropriate responses. I think that's a good definition of a sentient being. And you could maybe, from the point of view of Kazon's understanding here, is at the moment of an appropriate response, not so much when you're thinking about it, but the actual moment that an appropriate response becomes the appropriate response despite yourself, where you're not even thinking that it's an appropriate response, which would make it slightly inappropriate. At such a moment, you could say the one who just made that response could be called a non-sentient being for one moment, and then they think, oh, what a great response, and then they're sentient again. Or the person says, oh, that was really painful, and they say, oh, I guess I made a mistake, and then they're sentient.
Does a jellyfish ever make an inappropriate response?
Inappropriate?
Yeah. Does a bird flying make an inappropriate response? I don't see that, but they're sentient beings. it is the sapient being, is the one who can say, I'm going to do the inappropriate thing that needs saving.
Mm. Yeah, well, maybe we could say in some ways that, yeah, humans are the most deluded of all so-called sentient beings.
Yeah, so my jaw dropped because I was all kind of on this track for a while, and Rav said, you have to be fully sentient. You have to be fully sentient to get it.
Mm.
You know, and I think Dogen said something like that, the greatly enlightened is one who is aware of his delusion.
Mm. Yeah, great realization of delusion.
Yeah, so there's a sense of beginner's mind, for me anyway. I might be wrong, I'm not asserting this as a fact, but for me it seems that approaching beginner's mind is appropriate. It is approaching a mind of mere sentience, mere intelligent actor in a world being appropriate.
And it may be that at the very center of mere sentience is what we call non-sentience.
Non-sentience.
But that's what, we'll see how Kazan talks about this. So, meanwhile, like you say, this monk and the national is very persistent and really wants to get to the bottom of this with the national teacher. And then Dongshan knows this whole story, and he wants to get even further to the bottom of it. So when he goes to Guishan, he said, there's this long story about this person trying to understand the teaching of non-sentient beings, and I want to understand it even further than that story. So Dongshan quotes that whole long story we just heard to his teacher. And then when he finishes, Guishan, who he's with at this time, says, well, I have it too, but I have had no chance to meet an awakened person. Yeah. Another translation is, maybe this is better. He said, I also have it here, but I hardly ever meet anyone suitable for it. It's better. And Dongshan said, it's still not clear to me. I beg you to instruct me. Guishan raised his whisk, the fly whisk, and asked, do you understand? That non-sentient furry thing. Dongshan replied, no, I don't. Please explain. Guishan said, I can't explain it to you in words. Dongshan asked, is there someone else who sought the way when you did? Like, if you're not going to explain it to me, is there somebody else who can? And I feel like some connection to you here, but so is there somebody that you practiced with earlier on that can help me with this? Guishan said, if you go to the stone caves in Liling and Yuxian, you will find someone named Yunyan. If you stir up the grass and gaze into the wind, you will certainly be welcome. Dongshan said, he's a little hesitant. He said, well, what's he like? Guishan said, once you asked me, what should a student do when he wants to serve the master? And I said, he can do that for the first time when he puts an end to delusion quickly. He asked, would he still be able to not violate the master's teaching? I answered, the main thing is that you should not say, I am here. Another version of this kind of obscure dialogue. Is He once asked me what a student should do to serve the teacher. I told him that one must simply cut off attachments. That's how you serve. He asked if he would then be able to avoid violating my teaching. Once I've cut off attachments, then would it be possible to violate your teaching anymore? And I told him, first of all, not to say I am here. In other words, you can cut off all attachments, but if you say I am here, that's that violates it again. It's a little bit attached. The master ended by leaving Guishan and going straight to Yunyan. When he finished telling the above story, he asked, I don't know if he told the whole story about the national teacher, and then he recounted his own conversation with Guishan, and then he asked Yunyan, who can hear the non-sentient teach the Dharma? Please. Yunyan said, the non-sentient can hear it. Dongshan said, can you hear it? Yunyan said, if I heard it, you could not hear me teach the Dharma. So very similar, right? They're just almost the same. Dongshan said, why can't I hear it? Yunyan also raised his whisk and said, do you hear it? I mean, maybe he just heard this story about his experience with the last teacher, and he's just kind of like repeating the whole thing. And Dongshan said, no, I don't hear it. Yunyan said, if you still don't hear me teach the Dharma, how much less can you hear the non-sentient teach the Dharma? So in the original beginning story, that's when he had this awakening, but there's a little extra bit here for good measure. Dongshan said, just like that monk asking the national teacher, he said, what's the scriptural basis for the teaching of non-sentient? Give me another one. Yunyan said, don't you know that the Amitabha Sutra says, streams, birds, and trees all praise the Buddha and praise the Dharma. Hearing this, Dongshan was awakened. This situation started in the community of the national teacher and finally came to an end at Yunyan's place. That is, he uttered the verse, wonderful, wonderful, and so on. When he heard with his mind's eye, he understood at once. Dongshan told Yunyan, I still have some habits that are not yet exhausted. This was maybe the next day. He stayed after this with Yunyan, practiced with him, and received the Dharma from him. But sometime when they were practicing together, he said, well, I still have some habits that are not exhausted. I mean, I was able to, he didn't yet shut the door on his mother. That was later when he's at Dongshan. Yunyan asked, what have you done so far? Dongshan said, I haven't even practiced the Four Noble Truths. And it doesn't say here, but I think that Yunyan responds, if you haven't practiced the Four Noble Truths, then what can you fall into? And maybe another version of the story says, how can I avoid falling into steps and stages in my practice? Which is another version of, I still have some habits that are not exhausted. Like thinking of stages is a habit. And when he says, I don't even practice the Four Noble Truths, Yunyan says, well then what stages could you fall into? Yunyan asked, maybe at another time, maybe at the same time, are you happy? Are you joyful? Dongshan said, it's not that I'm not happy. It's like finding a bright pearl in a trash heap. I think that's one of my favorite stories of Dong Shan. It's not that I'm not joyful. It's just like finding this bright pearl in a trash heap in a pile of dung. So that, you know, I could be sitting in the very middle of this smelly trash pile and still not be not happy. He asked Yunyan, "What should I do when I want to meet my original self?" Yunyan said, "Ask the interpreter." Dongshan said, "I'm asking right now." Yunyan asked, "Well, what's he telling you?" So these are various stories of conversations between Dongshan and Yunyan. When the master was leaving Yunyan, Dongshan was leaving Yunyan, he asked, "After you die, if someone asks me, what was the master's truth, what should I say?" He's maybe not going to see him again, and that's his last question. After you die, if someone says, "What was Yunyan's teaching? What should I say to them?" Yunyan paused and then said, "Just this. Just this person." Dongshan was silent for a while. Yunyan said, "You must be extremely careful and thorough in realizing this thing." That's a nice excerpt too, because maybe you've heard that story. Great. So simple, so plain Zen story. How, if someone asks about your teaching after you're gone, what should I say is the essence of your Zen? Just this person. We love it, don't we? That's our Zen feast in three words. Like a donation box, right? It says, just yourself, this is enough. And so I think we love it because it's so simple, and here we are. How can you go wrong? So it's a nice little follow-up to this. He's silently absorbing that, just this person. Cool. And then his teacher says, "But actually, you must be extremely careful and thorough in realizing this." Yes. It's so simple and straightforward, isn't it? Dongshan still had some doubts as he left his teacher. Later, as he was crossing a stream, he saw his reflection in the water. As a result, he was greatly awakened to the prior instruction about just this. I visited Dongshan's temple in China, a small little temple, way out in the mountains. We almost didn't make it. We were like a little pickup truck, kept getting stuck in the mud. And it's pretty like run down little place, considering it's the founding temple of the Cao Dong lineage. Paint's all chipping off the walls and stuff. And on the way, it's like kind of a rural place too. There's this, the creek, the Dong Creek that's winding through, and you, there's a little bridge across, and the bridge is called meeting him or encountering it bridge. And this is the place where supposedly Dongshan crossed the creek and saw his reflection before that temple was there. So again, it's kind of interesting that he was just wandering through the wilderness and he had this awakening, and then it looks like he just like walked 50 feet up the road and said, I'm just going to stay here now. There's nowhere else to go. And that became the monastery. So he said in a verse upon this awakening, avoid seeking him or it in someone else, or you will be far apart from your true self. Solitary now am I and independent, but I meet him everywhere, or I encounter it everywhere. He now surely is me, but I am not him. Or as Dongshan himself later wrote in the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, you are not it, it actually is you. We chanted this morning. That's a line from his awakening poem. You are not it, it actually is you. Or I am not him, he surely is me. Understanding it in this way, you will directly be one with suchness. Dongshan's life work was completed and he was at once freed from doubt. This story is how it happened. This is one of the longer chapters in the Transmission of Light. We'll continue with Kazon's comments on this story about the non-sentient being teaching Dharma, and but maybe you can just reflect on what's the relationship between this teaching of the non-sentient and the light that's transmitted. Are the non-sentient beings actually transmitting light? May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I I vow to become it.